From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Dozens of cities this weekend, from New York to Seattle, were rocked by protests catalyzed by the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The pain and anger that echoed in streets across the country over the past several days has many sources. Those sources all run into a deep well of racism and violence in this country and how that intersects with policing. So this hour on Point, race, law enforcement, and policing. And we're going to begin today in Detroit with Stephen Henderson. He is host of WDET's Detroit Today, also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has reported from many American cities. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's always really good to have you. One of these days, I'm going to have you on a program and we're not talking about the issues that tear our country apart, okay? I promise that. But first of all, tell me, what has it been like in Detroit the past couple of days?
Well, I think chaotic is one word to use. There have been very large demonstrations each evening and into the night in our downtown area. And each night, those demonstrations have started out as peaceful protests, people trying to make the point that they're tired, exasperated by the police brutality that African Americans face, by systemic racism that fuels that brutality. But then when the sun goes down, to be honest, they have really turned into much more violent demonstrations than they were earlier in the day. The police are trying as hard as they can to keep control of things. They're doing what they should be doing in some cases, but they're also, I think, antagonizing in ways that have made it worse in some instances. There have been several journalists who've been assaulted by police or arrested for trying to do their jobs. So again, the level of chaos, I think, that we're experiencing is really overwhelming. But there's also, of course, just a deep sadness, I think, to all of this, that we continue to have to express ourselves this way, that we continue to have to push back against the systems and institutions that treat Black lives as though they are not equal. This is a narrative with roots that are decades and centuries old, but to have it rear its head now on top of a pandemic that is also devastating this city and the country and devastating African Americans in a way that's more profound than others, it really is bringing us to that space where we just kind of say it's too much. And I think it's hard in some cases to know how to feel or how to react at this point, because you kind of ask yourself, what else could go wrong? What else could happen right now?
Yeah, it is too much. And we're living in a moment that is the sum of all moments that have come before. And it's bigger than all of us. That said, forgive me for asking this, Stephen, but how are you processing this right now?
With great difficulty, and I don't have any shame in admitting that. The program that I host here in Detroit was supposed to be on vacation this week, and of course we are not because of all of the things that happened over the weekend, and so I had to, just like you, think about, okay, how do I help our listeners process all of this? And I really struggled with that. I don't know what to think about a lot of this. I don't know how to react to all of the weight of history and our past that seems knotted up in all of this. And one of the things I said to our listeners today was that's okay. It's okay to feel whatever you're feeling. It's okay to not know how you feel. And I think it's okay to be confused about what is happening. This is really complicated stuff, and it is wrought with very, very intense emotion. And as I said, knotted up in our history and our past in a way that makes it very difficult to think through what's happening, the value of what's happening, and to forecast into the future. What is it that we can get out of all of this? What can we make better? How do we dismantle institutions that perpetuate systemic racism that have existed in some cases since the country's founding? And so it was a difficult hour on the air for me, and I think for our listeners. And I think I will struggle for a long time with all of this. And I think it's important to say that's all right. That's okay. You do have to keep watching and listening and thinking and discussing. But I don't know that we're close to the time when we get to conclusions about this, where we get to say, here's what's going to happen. Here's how we are going to fix this.
Right. You know, I think in order, I'm a person who loves to seek solutions. But right now, you know, you asked about, you said about waking up this morning. Mm-hmm. Waking up this morning where I was like, you know, I don't know if we can, I can effectively seek solutions in this moment without first acknowledging the heartbreak, you know, that this is so much. It's too much for people. It's complicated. It's hard. It's painful. And without giving each other, as Americans, the space to experience that heartbreak, I'm not quite sure how we move forward. Mm-hmm. So that's where I am at this moment. And I'm relying on much smarter people than myself, people like you, Stephen, to sort of hold my hand as we navigate this space here. So hang on for just a moment, because I'm going to bring in another smarter person, okay? Smarter than me. But I like to surround myself with them, so.
Pretty smart yourself there, Magna.
Well, like you said, like, I am not ashamed to say, I don't know. Like, what do we do? So let's just talk about it. Let's just talk through it and figure out how do we get a little bit past the I don't know. So joining us now from Philadelphia is Erin Haynes. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization reporting about the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. And before she was with The 19th, Erin was also the national race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Erin, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's good to be with you, although not under these circumstances, obviously.
Yeah. So where are you right now? Just start us by, like, how are you thinking about, where was your head this morning when you woke up?
Well, honestly, when I woke up this morning, one of the things that was on my mind, and something that's been on my mind for about the past month, is the idea that we are experiencing the pandemic within a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. The dual ills of coronavirus and systemic racism, both of which must be confronted with a new normal that really says what we've been saying in coronavirus, right? We're all in this together. Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen whether that's going to be true as we, as the country is confronted with the systemic racism, yet another inequality in America that has been exposed in the midst of this coronavirus crisis. And so, you know, what I woke up thinking this morning was, what if we covered the virus of systemic racism the way we covered COVID-19, right? Like some of the things that we might be asking, how do people get sick? Right? What are the symptoms? Is there a cure? What is that cure? How long will it take? How much will it cost? Right? How do we get that cure to the most people? Who's the most affected by it and why? How do we keep people safe? You know, and what can we all do as citizens and neighbors to minimize harm? And what is the federal government's response to this? What is the response of our governors, our mayors? What is their responsibility? Right? Mm-hmm. And so these were some of the things that were on my mind. I'm in Philadelphia, which, you know, many Americans regard as the cradle of our democracy, right, where the Constitution was written. And that really makes me think a lot about what it means to be a citizen in this moment, right?
Yeah.
As you mentioned, Meghna, this is a moment that is not just about last week. It's not just about this year. It's not just about the past decade. I mean, this has been generations in the making. And the moment in which we now find ourselves is merely the latest accelerant to those things. You know, I started my career writing about the vestiges of racism and the legacy of the civil rights movement. And now, again, my focus is on the retrenchment and the retreat of the gains of racial progress that we have made as a nation. And so that is just deeply troubling for me as an American, but frustrating, disappointing, and painful for me as a Black person in America.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, respond to that about this idea of how powerful or powerfully important is it for us to sort of shift the frame, us being America, to shift the frame, as Aaron says, and you know, looking at racism as we look at the coronavirus pandemic.
I think that's a wonderful analogy. And if I could, I would sort of borrow and alter it just a bit. I think systemic racism is very much like a virus and very much like the COVID-19 virus in that it is, you know, spread very easily and very damaging. But I actually think that the way we respond to it in many ways in this country is more similar or more analogous to the way we deal with the common cold, which is also a virus that we just kind of accept that we have to live with. People assume that they will get sick and that they will maybe get better, and they don't respond with the urgency that we have to the coronavirus. So the shift is thinking of this as something that's virulent and dangerous and deadly, as opposed to something that's tolerable.
Well, Stephen Henderson and Aaron Haynes, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to think through and explore today not just the past 6 days in America, but the long road that led to the convulsion of pain and anguish and anger in American streets over the past couple of days, 6 days. And I'm joined today by Stephen Henderson. He's host of Detroit Today on WDET, and he's with us from Detroit. And Aaron Haynes is also with us. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. And before that, she was the national race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. And Aaron, so this metaphor or the call to look at racism as virulent, as a virus in the American body politic is a compelling one, and I want to explore that further with you because also last Monday, the same day that George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, in Central Park in New York City, I think we saw firsthand how that virus infects just about everyone, right? In the incident with Amy Cooper, a white woman, who called 911, who called the police on Christian Cooper, no relation, a black man, and in fact, a well-known birder in New York City, because he had asked her simply to leash her dog in an area of Central Park where dogs were required to be leashed. And the thing about that moment that I think is so profoundly relevant to what we're talking about now is, A, something like this happens every day somewhere in America, and B, before she even calls the police or dials 911, Christian Cooper captures this on the video he took. She looks at him and says knowingly, I am going to tell them an African-American man is threatening me. She says it to his face, like, here is my plan. So, first of all, what's your response to that? And how does that knowingness factor into what we're seeing now?
Yeah. Well, I think to continue with this, you know, the idea of the pandemic within a pandemic, I think that what we saw in the Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper incident is that, you know, this is systemic racism is a virus that lies dormant in too many Americans, right? That incident did not show that Amy Cooper just caught the virus of systemic racism, right? But it was something that came out of her in that moment. And the reason that something like that might occur is because of our country's long, fraught, and violent history around the weaponization of white privilege, and in particular, white womanhood. And so we can now add birding while black to the list of perceived infractions that for which black people, white people think that they can punish black people. And you know, Amy Cooper's actions, the reason that they were so problematic and troubling for so many Americans is that we know that her weaponizing 911 in that way can lead to just the type of moments that end up in the tragic situation that happened with George Floyd. And so those two incidents are inextricably linked in this moment. That is what makes both of these cases that much more egregious, is that they happened in the same weekend.
Mm. Well, hang on here, because I want to now bring into the conversation Catherine Russell Brown. She joins us from Gainesville, Florida. She's a professor and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Race Relations at the University of Florida Levin College of Law, and author of several books, including The Color of Crime and Protecting Our Own Race, Crime, and African Americans. Professor Russell Brown, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, reflect on what Aaron was just saying about how inextricably linked the incident in Central Park in New York was to the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Yeah, so they're intricately linked because of how we frame race in this country and how blackness has been framed contrary to whiteness. So if we think about the codes that existed during the time of slavery, when we think about the ways in which black life was and black movement was regulated and prescribed into certain spaces, and how just by creating that vertical relationship with whites at the top and blacks at the bottom, and making blacks less than with each piece of legislation. So whether we move past slavery and we look to the black laws that actually existed at the same time that slavery was going on, we move out of slavery to the black codes. Like at each time period, we have laws, we have legislation, we have cases, we have policies that punish the black body. So whether we're talking about Jim Crow, whether we're talking about sundown towns, whether we're talking about redlining. And so then when we fast forward and get to Amy Cooper, what we have is someone who's very clear on what the racial narrative is. And different from a lot of hoax cases, which I've spent a good bit of time studying, typically you don't have a hoax perpetrator, Amy Cooper in this case, saying out publicly that she is about to perpetrate a hoax. And in some ways, she was throwing that out there to Christian Cooper to see if that would be enough to stop him from continuing with the filming. Right. So she was very clear. And I've seen some commentary and some discussion, particularly online, about, well, did she know what, you know, the thing is, she knew what the narrative was that would get the police to come to her aid, that she was a white woman in distress. So she knew that in calling the police, that they would take her word over Christian Cooper's words. And this is exactly embedded into U.S. history in terms of testamentary capacity, whose words will be believed when officials are called in. So she knew that they would take her words and those would be placed above those of Christian Cooper's. And it seems to me that these types of hoaxes, although obviously in this case nothing happened, but it could have.
It could have.
And it could have. And even if it wasn't a killing or didn't lead to a serious physical injury, just the time, the delay, and the, you know, the holding of Christian Cooper is a harm on its own. And hoaxes should be subject to serious criminal punishment. In order to deter them, they should be subject to a serious criminal justice sanction beyond simply filing a false police report. They are very common. The ones that we hear about are the ones that make the news, but they take place and they cause great harm and they impede law enforcement officials' ability to do their job and have community trust because they create just the opposite.
Mm. You know, this is one of the things, one of the ways in which racism is revealed in terms of how it works in America, right? Because, I don't know Amy Cooper. I never had heard of her before this video came out last week. Maybe she's a good person. I mean, who knows? But the point is that in that moment, perhaps she was afraid or nervous. One of the reasons that might have been is because Christian Cooper is a black man and we're societal, socially just programmed to be afraid of black men for no reason. And secondly, even with the adrenaline of that fear, it's the calculus that she reveals, which is so revealing, right? She literally announces her plan. She says to him exactly what this is my plan of what I'm going to tell the police. And it's that calculus that I think it shows us how deeply to come back to Aaron's metaphor here, how deeply the virus of racism is, that not only did she feel like she could call the police and say this, but she announced it to him. And she said, this is what I am going to do.
Yeah, and she just happens to have not been successful, yeah. Right? In terms of, Cooper apparently had left, at that time. So, I mean, it didn't work. The threat did not work. But in many of these instances, they do lead to violence. So whether we talk about the Charles Stewart case, whether we talk about the Susan Smith case, whether we talk about Rosewood, whether we talk about Emmett Till, these cases have existed over time and they can lead to real harm and violence as a result of one person's word.
Right? And Megna, if I could just add to what Catherine is saying right here, I mean, you don't have to know Amy Cooper to know this scenario. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about this last week in the Washington Post. I mean, this concept, the idea of white womanhood is something to be protected and defended and that black men are inherently criminal is at the core of our American imagination, right? I mean, this was the premise of D.W. Griffith's very racist Birth of a Nation. It was the plot of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, one of our most beloved American stories. And I couldn't help but think to myself about To Kill a Mockingbird when the Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper exchange went down, because honestly, one of my first thoughts was, you know, what if Tom Robinson had a cell phone, right? You know, he would have been able to prove that he was in fact not the aggressor, not a criminal, but the victim in that exchange. But then at the same time, my mind also went to Mayella Ewell and what would have happened if she had had a cell phone and been able to weaponize 911. Tom Robinson maybe never would have made it to a courtroom. And so, you know, I think, decades later, what the difference here is with the advent of technology is that you have the cell phone as both a weapon for white Americans and white women in particular and as a tool for black people in this era.
Mm. Stephen, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really jumps out at me about the Amy Cooper situation is something that I think that when we're talking about solution making and trying to get to a better space is really important, because I think there are lots of instances in which white people, and in this case, this was a very knowing instance of this, but I think there are lots of unknowing instances of this idea of calling on the weight of institutions that are rife with bias or bigotry as a way of either defending yourself or advancing your own position. You act in a way that calls on all of that history and the weight of all of that bias against a person of color. This is one of the really important ways that individual action connects to systemic racism and perpetuates it. And I think it's one of the things that we need white Americans to be much more conscious of, that when they do that, even unknowingly, the consequences for black people can be devastating or even deadly.
Right. And we saw that on the very same day, right, in Minneapolis.
Yes.
Well, let's go to our callers. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes. Hello. Yes, I think that is a key point. I'm so glad you're bringing up the history, because we need to know this history. And as a white person, we need to know that history in particular. We have, today's been 99 years ago, the Tulsa white mob attacked and destroyed the black community in Tulsa. And as white people, we need to understand, rather than just bemoaning how could this possibly happen, but understand our role in perpetuating this violence. And we need to actively speak up and speak up in defense of the social justice for all people. Mm. And that is what will serve us in the long run.
Well, Chris, thank you for that call. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that he brought up the issue of kind of the history and responsibility for knowing the history. And I just want to say that all of these incidents are yet another reminder of what we need to do, what we need to better incorporate into K through 12 learning. Okay, it's atypical for students to be exposed to a detailed assessment, analysis, reading about the history of race relations in this country. So when we fast forward to people being out in the world, adults walking about, and then and no real awareness of, you know, beyond sort of, you know, the, you know, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, kind of, you know, slavery is a thing that happened, you know, led to a war, you know, very, very kind of cursory awareness or knowledge, I think we have to do better in K through 12 education. Mm. It's our only hope, because we can't wait until these cases happen to do something about them, right? So we should be making sure we're providing information, talking about this history, talking about racism, talking about white supremacy, talking about slave codes, talking about what this country was built upon and how that matters in terms of where we are today.
Erin, do you want to? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because Catherine is exactly right. I mean, I think one of the main questions confronting us in this moment is, what is the onus on white people, many of whom, frankly, have only recently begun to consider questions of white privilege and white supremacy, and what it means to be a white person in America right now, and what their responsibility is. Because what we've seen is that, you know, this is who we are as America. And so, you know, we have to all be asking ourselves, are we all in this together, like we say with the coronavirus? And are we prepared to choose a new normal?
Catherine, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we have to figure out a way so that we don't have to bump into these horrible circumstances. We don't have to, be presented with another dead Black person on video. And then we're now talking about what should be done. What should be done is that people should be made aware and that we should figure out some ways to obviously address concerns about de-escalation, implicit bias, all the things we've been talking about for years, racial profiling, all of that. But there are a series of front-end solutions that we need to recognize as well.
Well, we are talking about the complex history, not just of the past week or the past month, but the entire history of the United States that led to this moment, and trying to figure out how to think through that in the context of the past 6 days in the United States. I'm joined by Catherine Russell Brown and by Aaron Haynes and by Stephen Henderson as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be thinking about how we talk with children about this moment in American history, about race, about police violence, about the protests. So call us with your questions or your stories about how those conversations are going in your households, or what do you want to know about how to start those conversations. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's program. Today on the show, I'm joined by Stephen Henderson. He's host of Detroit Today on WDET in Detroit. Erin Haynes is also with us from Philadelphia. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. And Catherine Russell Brown joins us as well. She's professor and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Race Relations at the University of Florida, Levin College. College of Law. And let's go back to our callers. David is calling from Dayton, Ohio. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. So my comment is about an incomplete story here. You're slandering Amy Cooper insofar as you're not including that by his own admission, Mr. Cooper said to her, "I'm going to do something you're not going to like." And then he proceeded to call her dog to him. And we don't know if he was going to give the dog a treat or harm the dog or take the dog. And he's much bigger than her. And it put her in a situation. Now, it's abhorrent that she weaponized that threat. You know, it's implicit that the police are going to maybe harm him and maybe kill him. But it's disingenuous. It's poor journalism. And frankly, it's a slander of Amy Cooper. She reacted terribly, but she was, in fact, threatened. If somebody threatened my dog, I'm not sure what I would do.
Would you call the police and say a Black man is threatening me? Would you tell that person, I am going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening me, and then pick up the phone and say, there is a African-American man wearing a helmet. I'm in the Rambles in Central Park, and he is threatening me. Would you be that specific when you called the police?
I think that I already indicated that I condemn what she did, and I don't think that question's necessary. I think it's abhorrent to do that. And being put on the spot where there's somebody that's much bigger than you and they're threatening you, she was desperate. She's now been fired and vilified and called racist nationwide. And you didn't include that part, that she was in fact threatened.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that, and I actually appreciate you calling to point that out, David. I'd also like to point out that Christian Cooper himself has said that he does not think that she deserved to lose her job, and that perhaps we should all show her more compassion as well. But hang on here for a second, David. Don't hang up. I want to turn your question to Catherine Russell Brown and get Professor Russell Brown's response to what you're bringing up.
So I think the caller is accurate as far as, you know, what happened before, the information that we were able to see. But I'd like to point out as well that her behavior didn't suggest that she actually felt threatened. What we also saw was her moving toward Christian Cooper and trying to get him to stop filming. So, yes, under the circumstances, someone could have been threatened, but it does not feel threatened, but it does not appear that she was. So that's the concern here, is that she was saying that she felt threatened when under the circumstances she actually wasn't.
If I could just add to what Catherine was saying, this entire exchange doesn't happen if Amy Cooper was not breaking the rules. Her dog was off leash. This is what that is the initial conversation. And her response is not to comply, not to put her dog on the leash, as were the rules, but to turn the situation around on him, to make him the one who was unruly. And so, you know, I understand that she may have felt threatened, that she may have felt an instinct to protect her dog. But why is the response to that racism? I mean, who doesn't know the consequences of weaponizing the police against Black people at this point? And why should Christian Cooper's actions potentially result in his death? I mean, I think we have to be asking, regardless of whatever was in Amy Cooper's mind in that moment, is racism a response to imminent danger? Hmm.
Stephen, go ahead.
And the danger, it seems to me, is the dog, this loose dog in the park, to Christian Cooper. I mean, and I don't want to embarrass the caller or chastise him in any way, but the idea that Christian Cooper didn't feel threatened in that moment, the idea that he wasn't concerned for his personal safety because there's a loose dog nearby, but that he's sort of very quick to accept the idea that Christian Cooper was somehow a threat to Amy Cooper. And again, I think we need white America to think differently about these things, to react differently to these situations, and not jump to the conclusion that a Black man asking a white woman to leash her dog is somehow threatening, and that he didn't feel threatened by the loose dog.
Yeah. David, are you still with us?
Stephen is so right.
I am. And it's pretty much the on radio effect of being ratioed. And that was the comment that was just made was disingenuous. He threatened her. He said, "I'm going to do something you don't like." And it's speculative to say that we don't think that she was threatened.
Okay.
It's not just black and white. There's gray in there. And, you know, what do we want to be remembered for the rest of our lives for a horrible decision that we made in a stressful situation?
Well, so David,
if we don't do race relations any favors by not telling the whole truth.
Well, Aaron, I promise I'm going to come back to you. Hang on for just a second. So, David, you're right. There's no conversation about race that should happen in black and white. We have to take into account all the complexities. But part of you said the right word. You said, like, so talking about decisions that we make every single day. And I wonder what stopped Amy Cooper from just deciding to leash her dog and walk away. That's really, I want to know what it is that prevented that decision from happening. Because the truth is that if someone calls the police on a black man, the chances of something terrible happening to that black man are higher than for any other person in the United States. So what I want to know is what's stopping us from actually taking a deep breath, stepping back and being like, this is no big deal. I'm just going to leash my dog and walk away. There's something profound in the American psyche that doesn't let that happen. And I want to understand that, David.
Right. And I think to speculate and pull another trope out, I think it's accurate to say she was behaving like a Karen, as they say, with a sense of entitlement. She was clearly in the wrong. And still wouldn't admit it and say, I'm sorry, sir, I'll put my dog on a leash. No, she asserted her sense of entitlement and then played the race card in a horrible, horrifying way.
Mm. And what I can't remember if it was Aaron or Catherine who wanted to get in here before.
Yeah. Hi, Aaron. Okay. And David, I appreciate this conversation and I appreciate your wanting to talk through this. I think a couple of things, too, that are worth pointing out in this exchange. I mean, the entire video, watching it in its totality, Amy Cooper, did not appear to fear for her life, because what does she do as the camera starts rolling? She approaches Christian Cooper and tells him to please stop recording her, to which he responds, please don't come close to me, repeatedly. Repeatedly, he says that to her. And so if she was afraid of him, confronting him and getting that close to him also seems like an illogical response. And also, you know, to your point about her concern for her dog, the dog, as a dog owner myself, I couldn't help but be drawn to the dog in that video. She is clutching his collar. The dog, Henry, is writhing and yelping against the collar that she's holding while she is making this call, so much so that the adoption agency where she got the dog was concerned enough that she had to surrender him.
Hmm. Well, David, I want to say once again, thank you so much for calling, because, look, these are hard conversations and we are willing to have them as deeply as we possibly can in the context of a radio show. So thank you so much for calling. Let's just move on to see if we can get a couple more voices in here. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes. I mean, with that little conversation, even though sometimes you have proof to show, we still, as a black, get the blame. But my point is, I am tired of our black leaders. They haven't done nothing to try to help the tension, to diffuse nothing from the police, the aggression to us. I mean, you could go back and see how many of us have been beaten, killed, and it's like, okay, there goes another one. And then you're going to tell us we should not get angry. We should not get upset. The whole scenario is, from every action, there's a reaction. From every action, there will be a reaction.
Paul, may I just ask, when you say black leaders, who specifically are you talking about?
All of them. It doesn't matter. I wish if one of them, several of them, could tell me something from Dr. King. They marched with him, some of them. Now, from all those proceedings, tell me something what I have done to help diffuse tension. We talk about it over and over. Yeah. Every year, someone killed by the police. Mm. They got proof.
Right. Well, Paul, I'm going to take it back from you there, mostly just because I'm very mindful of the time. But thank you so much for that. Aaron Haynes, do you want to respond to Paul's critique?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would say to that is, in this moment, what we are seeing in the absence of a national response to our current moment of racial unrest, it is, in fact, many black leaders, including black women, who are filling that leadership void, speaking out and trying to balance their dual identities around being African-American, but also being leaders in Congress, mayors in a lot of cases. I mean, I'm from Atlanta, and I just wrote an opinion piece about my hometown after I saw Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, a Black woman who is a mother to four Black sons, who was very emotional in asking for calm for, you know, her city as Atlanta was really reaching a boiling point headed into the weekend. You know, even as she understands Black America's outrage over yet another incident of the killing of an unarmed Black man by police. Val Demings, a Florida congresswoman, former Orlando police chief, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post just last week asking her former fellow law colleagues, I think we are seeing some examples of Black leadership, like I said, particularly coming from Black women across the country.
I want to sneak in one last call here, if I can. And Professor Russell Brown, forgive me, but I just want to see if I can get Lauren, who's calling from Tampa, Florida, on the air. Lauren, we've just got a little bit of time left, but go ahead and share your thought.
Hi, thank you. So I'll be quick. I am a 57-year-old white woman. I served in the United States Marine Corps from 84 to 93, and I am absolutely brokenhearted at where our country is going. But when I try to have conversations with my peers, obviously white women and men, these are the points that I get shot back at me a lot of times in anger. Like the caller before us with the both-siderisms, it kind of drives me crazy. That white equals scared, so it's okay.
So, Lauren, I'm going to take it back from you there just because we, like, literally have 90 seconds left. And the question that I think you wanted to get to is how do you start those conversations productively? And I appreciate that. Catherine Russell Brown, again, because I'm like a solutions person, I want to at least come to a place where I think Lauren's question is a good one. How do you start this conversation?
Yeah, it is a good one. And she's, from what she's saying, she's already started the conversations and they don't always go smoothly. People don't always hear what you're saying, but you have to keep having the conversations. One of the main threads we've seen in terms of the last few days is that people saying white people have to talk to white people about white people, right? So having these conversations, they don't proceed as things you can kind of put together and tie them up in a nice bow and put down. They aren't comfortable. And I think, again, it goes back to people learning and reading more, because sometimes people want to start talking about crime rates. They want to start talking about disproportionate crime rates. But that's an issue. And we can talk about that, but we can also talk about white violence or violence by police, discriminatory treatment. I mean, we have to be able to talk about all of this.
Well, hopefully we had a little taste of that today, and we'll keep working at it, okay? So Catherine Russell Brown, professor and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Race Relations at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. Professor Russell Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. Aaron, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
And Stephen Henderson, host of Detroit Today on WDET in Detroit. Stephen, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Thanks very much for including me.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.